Next week marks the third anniversary of an incredibly consequential U.S. Supreme Court decision that struck down key provisions of landmark civil rights legislation. The High Court's 5-4 ruling in Shelby County versus Holder meant that many southern states no longer had to seek federal approval to change their election laws under the Voting Rights Act. But what happened and how we got there is so much more complicated and will take some time to unpack. Here to do that on this episode of Oklahoma Voices is University of Oklahoma political scientist Keith Gaddy. In 2005 and 2006, he testified before both the U.S. House and Senate Judiciary Committees about renewing Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. He and his colleagues Justin Wirt and Charles Bullock just published a book titled The Rise and Fall of the Voting Rights Act. Keith Gaddy, welcome to Oklahoma Voices.
It's good to be back.
To really understand the narrative arc of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, we really have to go back almost 100 years to the end of the Civil War and the three so-called Reconstruction Amendments to the U.S. Constitution, 13th, 14th, and 15th, and specifically the 15th Amendment, which was ratified in 1870, and it says a person cannot be denied the right to vote based on race, color, or previous condition of servitude, so slavery. So African Americans really legally had the right to vote for 95 years. Why did we even need a Voting Rights Act?
Well, we needed a Voting Rights Act because you couldn't count on the states acting in good faith to comply with the 14th and 15th Amendments. And also, for nearly a century, the U.S. government had done very little to defend voting rights under the 15th Amendment. And you fall into a long, deep period of disfranchisement. Now, what happens after that is a lot of states start putting into place a variety of practices and laws that are designed to solidify through policy and law the disfranchisement that intimidation has already wrought. And by 1910, across the South, across the 12-state South, it includes Oklahoma, you have a variety of different acts, state actions that have been put into place that keep blacks out of the polling place, and the last black office holder has been driven from politics.
So fast forward to when we're starting to see cracks in this long, deep period in the 1950s. We're starting to see some first voting rights laws at the federal level. What was it like for a black voter as these were being implemented?
Well, you know, it was a very difficult proposition. Until 1957, there was no federal statute on the books to enforce voting rights. What you had had is a series of court decisions that had happened, and they had struck down a thing called the Grandfather Clause, and that was a case litigated in Oklahoma, the gun case in 1913, so a century ago. Then they had knocked back the white primary in Texas and other states, initially in 1927, then in 1935, and then finally for good in 1944, 45, 46. But for a black voter, it was still a very difficult proposition to get to register. In many of these states, you had to deal with a literacy test or an understanding test to demonstrate that you had educational competence to vote. And the voting registrars implemented these tests in a highly discriminatory fashion. In some states, you had to pay a poll tax, which disfranchised both blacks and poor whites. You might have other onerous requirements regarding the showing of papers or proof of residency. And local registrars who registered people to vote had all this discretion, and they would discriminate in a highly effective fashion, especially in the Deep South, that arc that goes from South Carolina to Louisiana. So it was very difficult to get in to register to vote. In 1960, the Deep South state with the highest rate of black voter registration was Georgia, which only had one in four blacks eligible to vote registered. If you tried to vote, you could confront violence. In 1946, a black man voted in the gubernatorial election in Georgia and was shot dead in the streets in Spalding County. The only black man to vote in the county was shot dead. So you have a white establishment in the Deep South in particular that is absolutely determined to not let blacks have access to the ballot.
So we get to 1965. After the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and President Johnson really wants to make voting rights a central piece of his legacy, what is it about the 1965 Voting Rights Act that didn't work with earlier versions that you had alluded to earlier, the 1957 version, the 1960 version? what worked about 65 that didn't work earlier?
Well, what had happened is LBJ had really been chipping away at voting rights enforcement with a series of baby steps. The 57 and 1960 acts had basically put into place the tools the Justice Department needed to be able to bring lawsuits against against jurisdictions that were discriminating. And it gave them the ability to secure voting records and to prosecute efforts to violate voting rights under the 14th and 15th Amendment. But what happened in 65 is you get an act with teeth. When LBJ went after this new law following the violence at Selma Bridge in March of 1965, what he did is he asked his Attorney General, Nick Katzenbach, for the toughest goddamnedest voting rights law he could write. And Katzenbach came back with it. What made it different was it gave the national government the authority to basically freeze in place all election laws and practices in states where you had really low voter participation, and to force a state to show that if it wanted to change its election practices, that the change didn't discriminate on the basis of race, that it didn't make blacks better off than they were previously. It also made it possible for either an individual or for the national government to bring a lawsuit anywhere in the country where someone's right to vote had been violated based upon discriminatory intent. So what happens is, for the first time in 100 years, the national government is preempting the ability of states to implement what is a state function, the conduct of elections. And it was termed the Second Reconstruction by scholars. Southern white segregationists flew up the flag of states' rights again, arguing that their states' rights have been violated. And it was a battle. It was a battle in the courts, all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. It was a battle in the states to get compliance. And, initially the toughest part of the act only affects all or part of seven states, all in the South, North Carolina, Virginia, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi.
Okay. Well, that's where I want to go next, because how exactly does this Voting Rights Act work? You called it an act with teeth a minute ago, and it's a fairly complex piece of legislation. There are multiple sections. Sections 4 and 5 are probably the two most important. There are conditions that have to be met. If you had 2 minutes in an elevator to explain to me what this piece of legislation does.
In 1965, a governor of Mississippi observed that legislatures can pass laws faster than courts can turn them over. This was an indication that states couldn't be counted upon to act in good faith to comply with existing law or to comply with the courts. So there was an assumption of bad faith on behalf of the states, so you had to change the rules of the game and take the game out of the courtroom and put it into the hands of prosecutors and bureaucrats. So we started with an assumption of bad faith in any state where you had a very low level of voter participation and a historic use of what's called a test or device to qualify to vote. Okay, this is what the Section 4 coverage formula does. It determines those areas of the country that ought to be picked up by the law. And the rule was, at initial implementation, in 1964 were less than half of the voters in an eligible jurisdiction either registered to vote or turned out to vote. That's step one. Step two was a test or device used to qualify to vote. This picked up all of the Deep South states from South Carolina through Louisiana, all of Virginia, plus about half of the state of North Carolina. In those states, if they change a registration requirement, if they changed the location of a polling precinct, if they went from a majority vote to a plurality vote, if they redistricted their districts, if they changed their registration form, it required them to automatically come back to the national government or the D.C. District Court and ask the court to approve the change.
This is that concept of preclearance, right?
That's preclearance, yeah. So the trigger under Section 4 says this is a county or a state that has to have its change in law precleared. Preclearance is the process of the state showing they haven't discriminated. So the burden of proof is put on the state rather than on the person bringing suit. There are only two places in the U.S. where the burden of proof resides on the party being charged. One is the Voting Rights Act, Section 5, and the other one is when you deal with the IRS. So that is it in a nutshell. But the other thing the law did is it suspended all tests and devices. So it temporarily and then later on permanently suspended the use of any test or device to qualify people to vote. So literacy tests, understanding tests, they go out the window. It becomes much easier to register to vote and much more difficult for a state to change their election law in a manner that will discriminate against minority voters.
And why were some of the states covered by Section 5 more so than others? You just mentioned that less than half of North Carolina was covered, but the entire state of Virginia had to meet this preclearance requirement, which, again, is basically federal approval to any changes of state or local election law.
Yeah, well, you know, and part of that, if you look at the five states that are picked up entirely, these are the most heavily black states in the U.S. at the time. These are the Deep South states. So they had widespread and total segregation in those states. You get to North Carolina. North Carolina's got a peculiar topography and a peculiar political history. And North Carolina had a history of Republicanism in the mountains. And really, the African-American population is largely centered in a few counties, in about 40 or 50 counties to the east, down in the low country. So what happens is the areas that have got voter participation issues are mainly in the African-American communities in that part of the state. Virginia has the same geography and the same history, but they for years have been run by a political machine called the Byrd Machine, which had made a really aggressive use of the poll tax to keep voter participation very, very low. V.O. Key talks about this in his classic book, Southern Politics and State and Nation. Virginia just had generally abysmal voter participation. So when the preclearance trigger went in, the coverage formula went in, it just picked up the whole state.
Going through time then, what kind of problems did we see after 1965 through the 1970s, the 1990s, even into the modern day? You wrote about a town in Mississippi that canceled a municipal election in 2006. I mean, how did these cities and states think they would survive scrutiny under this act?
Well, you know, when you're covering enough jurisdictions, it's hard to keep up with everybody. I mean, the voting rights section is not small up at DOJ, but it's not huge either. And if you do the math on it real quick, by the 1980s, there are all or parts of 9 southern states and all or parts of 16 states around the country covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And what happens is it's just too hard to keep up with everything. I mean, if you look at the state of Georgia as an example, the state of Georgia had 159 counties, several hundred municipalities, several hundred more school districts, all of which hold elections, all of which have got to be covered by the Voting Rights Act, all of which have got to be scrutinized by the DOJ's voting division. Unless somebody brings a lawsuit, you're not going to be able to keep up with the fact that these things have been happening, because the only way DOJ can monitor things is either to have a lawsuit brought or to have a complaint brought.
So it's reactive.
Right, it's reactive. Or to look at the documentation that comes in when there is a change in voting practice. So you look at Shelby County, Alabama. Shelby County itself never really had any major issues as a county government, but many of the municipalities in Shelby County had failed to report annexations, failed to report changes in voting practices, had failed to comply with the preclearance provision for years, and they would be sued over these things eventually. But yeah, a part of it was you just keep cheating until you get caught.
Which states were implementing the Voting Rights Act well and which ones weren't?
Okay, we can't say success is not getting sued, because sometimes you're violating the law and you still don't get sued. The most recent round of implementation of voting rights changes in terms of redistricting were highly successful. Most states were able to implement and get pre-cleared with relatively little difficulty. So redistricting has been a success. The states have learned and learned hard how to redistrict without violating the law. It's taken 4 cycles to do that. The states, it's better to point out the states that are just having problems and can't get over it. And Texas probably has more problems with voting rights than any state in the union. Okay, they are the biggest state that was ever wholly covered by the Voting Rights Act. They have more cities and counties than any state ever fully covered by the Voting Rights Act. They have more preclearance objections than any large state. They have more Section 2 lawsuits brought against them than any state. And they have more problems in law.
Is that just a factor of population, though, since they have close to 30 million people? I mean, is it just a size thing?
Well, Texas is big, and we know that.
Everything's bigger in Texas.
Everything's bigger in Texas. But, you know, it's the states that follow up behind it in terms of having problems are Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia. Okay, but Georgia's another really big state. Georgia's roughly half the size of Texas. But Texas in particular seems to get dragged into court more often, more recently, more consistently over redistricting, over voter identification laws, over the implementation of local voting practices. Texas also is the one big state that confronts problems with African American and Hispanic voting. So it presents a very, very interesting mixed bag. In terms of success, though, the successful states in terms of impact are probably Georgia and Mississippi. These are states that have record levels of African-American elected officials, okay? But also these are states where actually across the Deep South, black voter participation rates are higher than white voter participation rates. The 2012 election nationwide, an African-American was more likely to vote than an Anglo-white. So the act had its impact, even with voter ID laws being implemented across the South after 2008. African-American voters still turned out at a higher rate than Anglo-whites. So in terms of impact, the emboldening of these populations, the election of representatives of choice, has had a tremendous impact. The downside is that African-Americans and Hispanics almost entirely Democrats when elected to office. And these are all states that have gone decidedly to the Republican Party in terms of their majority. So you have a situation where African-American and Latino representatives are usually part of a minority party romp inside a white Republican-dominated legislature. So there's limited impact they can have on substantive policy in their states.
I want to pick up on what you just said about record levels of black elected officials, especially in Georgia and Mississippi. How did the Voting Rights Act affect blacks that may have been running in these elections?
Well, what it did is it created opportunities to win by creating districts where they could win initially. The initial breakthrough is often in one of two places, either the creation of districts where an African-American candidate can secure the majority of the vote, okay? The other is by simply assuring that black voters are able to register and turn out. You don't need a majority black district to elect an African-American lawmaker in the South anymore. But it really is those two things, creating opportunities to run and then assuring that voters can get to the polling place. And this has entailed both the use of the Voting Rights Act Section 5 to leverage southern states starting in 1992 to create these opportunities at the state legislative, county, and congressional level. But also by creating the perception that you can win. The funny thing is, if you look at Georgia in particular, by 2002, African-American candidates were winning statewide in Georgia as Democrats, winning as attorney general, winning as labor commissioner, winning as state judges. So there was a brief period where African-Americans were winning as Democrats statewide and getting 30-35% of the white vote as a crossover. There's really no difference in the South anymore between a black Democrat and a white Democrat in terms of how they put together an electoral coalition. Once you get above a state legislative district, it's all pretty much the same kind of politics.
In the years since the Voting Rights Act was passed, what kind of challenges has it seen? There were arguments by the mid-2000s by people like Edward Blum and Lynn Westmoreland that the Voting Rights Act had essentially outlived its usefulness.
Edward Blum is an interesting character, an interesting fellow. He was a businessman, an investor out of Texas who ran for Congress in a majority black district and got beat soundly. And Edward looked around and discovered that the Voting Rights Act had been used to basically gerrymander most black voters, most Hispanic voters into majority-minority districts. And these districts elect representatives from those communities by and large. But Edward Blum thought, you know, this really isn't fair. A voter's a voter. A place is a place. And he thought that this constituted a discriminatory effect. You were discriminating by race in the creation of the districts. And Edward also thinks that if you look at the Act, the original purpose of the Act was simply to allow people access to the ballot. It shouldn't apply to redistricting. So what happens is he sets about funding research and funding litigation to challenge a lot of these districts, arguing that they were narrowly tailored on the basis of race, or there was no other rationale for them to exist. And starting in 1995, he funds a bunch of lawsuits that come on the heels of a case out of North Carolina called the Shaw case that challenge all these districts, and they go to the Supreme Court and they win. They get these districts tossed out that they've been narrowly tailored on the basis of race. There was no other explanation for them, and therefore they violated the equal protection provision of the 14th Amendment. So the states have got to go back to the drawing board and figure out how to comply with the Voting Rights Act Section 5, which demands that they consider race, yet comply with the 14th Amendment, which says they can't consider race. So by the first decade of this millennium, Edward Blum has been funding both litigation and research looking into the effectiveness of the Act and how it might be updated and changed. And in particular, he's raised a concern that I shared, which was that the coverage formula for the Act, the old Section 5 formula we talked about a few minutes ago, needed to be updated, and that it was outdated, it was based upon bad data. And the fact was, he was right. So when the Act came up for renewal in 2005-6-7, a variety of legal and politics scholars were called in to testify in front of the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House about this. And Edward Blum had provided Chuck Bullock and I with a very nice grant to research this problem. And a lot of that research went into our first book, Triumph of Voting Rights in the South. And when I appeared in front of the U.S. Senate, the argument that I made was that it's possible the Act has had a significant impact, but the impact is variable from state to state. But we need to look at updating the coverage formula because there is a legal vulnerability there. So Blum writes his own body of research in his own book based upon a lot of the data that we had collected. And he goes out looking for test cases to challenge the Voting Rights Act Section 4 and Section 5. And he finds one down in Texas called the Namudno case, which had to do with the ability of jurisdictions to get out from under coverage under the law. And that's a successful case in 2009, wherein this little utility district outside of Austin is told, yeah, you don't have to be covered by the Act anymore. You're in compliance. You don't have problems. So they bail out. Justice Robertson, writing for the majority, cautions Congress that the Act might be vulnerable and they might want to revisit the coverage formula. They don't do anything. 4 years later, another suit has come, the Shelby County case out of Alabama, that directly challenges the coverage formula for the Voting Rights Act, again, based upon your voter turnout and participation in 1972, so 40 years prior, and whether or not you had used a test or device at the time. And they get into federal court and they lose. They get to the appellate court, they lose, get to the Supreme Court says, nope, this provision of the law is unconstitutional. It's not using the latest available data. The data are not appropriate to the problem. They don't pick up the right jurisdictions. Congress needs to go back and fix it. So what happens is, if you think about a gun has got a bullet, a trigger, a hammer, and a firing pin, okay? The trigger provision of the Voting Rights Act is Section 4, which indicates whether or not you're covered. By throwing out the formula for Section 4, they left the trigger in place, but they took out the firing pin, which means there's no way to get a bullet out of the gun on preclearance. And in one stroke in June of 2013, what happens is 16 states and several thousand jurisdictions that have been undergoing close scrutiny under the Voting Rights Act are suddenly freed. And within hours, they're passing legislation that had been clogged up in preclearance on things like photo ID and redistricting that was being litigated at the time under Section 5. And they move this legislation and start implementing this law again.
You wrote that the ideological makeup of the Supreme Court created an appellate climate that was ripe for a Voting Rights Act challenge. And that really did come to a head in this Shelby County, Alabama case. What did you mean by appellate climate ripe for a Voting Rights Act challenge?
Well, what it meant was that after the 2009 case, after the Namudno case, Justice Roberts had communicated language.
The Namudno case is North Austin Municipal Utility District
number one. Yes, yes.
And that case didn't invalidate parts of the Voting Rights Act, but it did set the stage for what we would eventually see in Shelby County in 2013.
Yeah, yeah. And what happened is you've got really two decisions in that case. You've got two opinions. The majority opinion written by Justice Roberts and joined by most of the court allows Namudno, the utility district, to get out from under Section 5 coverage, do what's called bailing out. But in that decision, Justice Roberts talked at some length about all the change that had occurred in the South and all the change that had occurred in the voting rights covered states. And he talked about the potential vulnerability of having a coverage formula, a trigger, that was based upon old data. Justice Thomas writes another opinion, basically articulating the argument for throwing out the Act. And Justice Thomas has been hostile to the Voting Rights Act throughout his tenure on the Supreme Court. The only African-American on the court is the most hostile member of the court towards the Voting Rights Act. So 4 years later, Shelby County comes down the pike with a challenge that does not allow the Supreme Court to duck the issue. What we meant when we said the environment was ripe was the court had sent a signal in the majority decision and in Justice Thomas's decision that there was a defect in the law. They had basically said Congress needs to address this. It was like an invitation to challenge again. It didn't matter what the appeal looked like when it got to the Supreme Court. If an appellate court had – if a district court threw out the act and then the appeals court sustained it, the Supreme Court was in a position to sustain the logic. If a district court sustained the act and an appellate court upheld the district court, there were five votes on the Supreme Court to consider an argument to overturn the act. And that's exactly what happened. Now, here's the irony, which is if this challenge had just been delayed for about 2.5 years and it had shown up after the passing of Justice Scalia, it had come out of the Fifth Circuit affirming the district court decision, which upheld the Voting Rights Act. Okay? This wouldn't have happened because the court would have tied 4-4, and that means that the lower court's opinion would have been upheld. So sometimes one vote matters, and sometimes timing is very, very important.
The Supreme Court has become more conservative over the past 25 years, and you wrote about the rise of this concept of equal state sovereignty that elevates states' rights and limits federal power. What's next? Where does this go from here, and how does this logically play out? And I suppose a lot of that will depend on who the next justice of the Supreme Court is.
This is why the next appointee to the High Court is so important. This is the cool thing about Justice Roberts. If you go back through his decade on the court, he'll leave these little nuggets sitting around in opinions, and you're not sure why they're there. Okay, and the way that my co-author Justin Work likes to put it is, he'll leave these acorns sitting around, and then he'll sweep in with a hand and harvest them all up, and create some new precedent out of them. Okay, and when you look at the Roberts Court, he'll leave these things sitting around, these little kernels, and there's a kernel that was sitting there inside the Namudno case, which was this notion that that the evidence had to be timely and appropriate to the problem. And so he swept that little acorn up and used it in Shelby County. But in Shelby County, he leaves this giant acorn waiting to grow into an oak. And this giant acorn is the idea of the equal sovereignty of the states. Now, this is really a very technical concept, and Justice Ginsburg pretty much nails this in her dissent, that equal sovereignty simply holds that any new states coming into the Union enjoy the same privileges and immunities and considerations as states that had come in before them. Okay, just because you were part of the original 13 doesn't make you special. Just because you're Texas doesn't make you special. Okay, every state gets treated the same. Roberts has turned this into a new kind of doctrine, which is that if there is federal law being applied that treats different states differently, it's not giving these states equal protection under the law and equal consideration, and implicitly by extension, it's not giving their citizens equal consideration and equal protection.
And to me, that sounds like the very antithesis of the Voting Rights Act.
Exactly. But the thing is, though, the Voting Rights Act existed because the states were treating their citizens in an unequal fashion and resulting in an unequal outcome of American citizens based upon where they lived, that where you live was going to dictate the scope of rights you would enjoy under the federal Constitution, that the national government – and this is the argument I've made – is that if we're going to use something as vague as the equal sovereignty of the states to try and limit the federal government's ability to hold the states into compliance, the national government should just come along and use the guarantee clause of a Republican form of government to compel the states into equal protection, equal treatment of their citizens. That if we're going to start using these vague and general parts of the Constitution, there's plenty in there for Congress to play with and make use of. But yeah, Roberts creates this new standard, this new doctrine. And this thing has got tremendous legs. You can bring it to bear on the Voting Rights Act Section 2, which allows you to bring suit around the country. You could use it on equal employment law. Okay, you could use it on the Civil Rights Act of 1964 in terms of those interstate commerce protections that are extended to guarantee access to public facilities and access to public establishments. You could, in theory, use this to roll back pretty much anything that's been done since about 1913 in terms of federal legislation that extends the reach of the national government to compel compliance by the states.
And I think you're starting to answer what my concluding question is, and I don't want to come across as dismissive here, but I'm curious about the tangible, noticeable impact of a decision like this. How does something like Shelby County affect me and my day-to-day life?
Well, you know, Brian, you're a white guy. You'll probably be okay. But if you're a woman or you're an African-American or a Hispanic, it means that the return of a variety of discriminatory practices, latent practices in the economic community by local governments could be used against you. And you'd have little recourse and little redress outside of the state courts. And you'd be largely protected by your state law rather than by federal law. Or alternatively, you'd have to meet a higher standard of proof that your constitutional rights have been violated rather than simply some statutory authority passed by Congress. It means that defending rights becomes a one-at-a-time thing where you have to go prove that you're discriminated against instead of having affirmative protection to your advantage.
Is there a solution? Is there a way to soften that?
You know, we've been trying for a half century. Honestly, I think Abraham Lincoln had the only solution, which is we have to appeal to the better angels of people's nature. That's the only way we get there. We're going to change people one at a time. But we have to protect everybody at the same time. And there's only one institution that can do that, and that is the national government.
Keith Gaddy, the author with Charles Bullock and Justin Wirt of The Rise and Fall of the Voting Rights Act, thank you so much for being with me on Oklahoma Voices.
Brian, it's a pleasure to be here.
You've been listening to my conversation with University of Oklahoma political scientist Keith Gaddy. You can read excerpts of the book we've been talking about on our website, kgou.org. We've also shared it on social media. You'll find us on Facebook and Twitter at KGOU News. The views and opinions expressed this half hour do not necessarily reflect those of KGOU or our licensee, the University of Oklahoma. My thanks to KGOU intern David Ransom for helping put this interview together for our website. For Oklahoma Voices, I'm Brian Hardzinski. Stay tuned next for Here and Now with national and local headlines from NPR and KGOU.